Welcome to another edition of The Week Ahead in Russia, RFERL's regular podcast about significant developments and upcoming events in Moscow and beyond. I'm Mike Eckel, senior correspondent here in Prague, filling in for our regular host, Steve Gutterman. 1993, February, St. Petersburg. Russian authorities announced the seizure of over a metric ton, more than $100 million, of cocaine. The cocaine was stashed in cans of corned beef that was shipped from Colombia and smuggled into Russia by road via Finland. The man whose agents seized the drugs was Viktor Cherkesov, known during Soviet times as a merciless KGB investigator. He was also a confidant of another KGB alumnus who at the time was St. Petersburg's deputy mayor and the man overseeing the city's foreign affairs. That's Vladimir Putin. Cherkesov, who headed the Russian drug agency, promised high-profile criminal trials into the coke bust. Nothing ever happened. Cherkesov's office halted the investigation 7 months later, saying merely that the main suspects had fled the country. The cocaine itself disappeared from view. A new investigation by RFERL has uncovered multiple links between individuals implicated in the drug smuggling and the St. Petersburg mayor's office where Putin worked. The findings echo past allegations that Putin himself was involved in the drug smuggling. It's all a very interesting asterisk in the political trajectory of Putin. And join me now to discuss the RFERL investigation are two of its authors. That would be Andrei Sushnikov, an investigative correspondent with Current Time, and Carl Schreck, RFERL's enterprise editor. Здорово, мужики. Добро пожаловать.
Здравствуйте, Mike. Hello, Mike.
Hello, everyone.
Great. So thanks for joining me, guys. And again, the new investigation, which you can find in Russian and in English on our websites, is in fact the first in a series of upcoming articles looking into the backstory of Putin's rise to power. If you want to understand what Putinism is, and you want to understand why what Russia is today, why Russia is what it is today, the oligarchs, the Siloviki, capital flight, offshore banks, sanctions, all of it, you have to first take a look at St. Petersburg, Putin's hometown, and where he first made the transition into politics. Andrei, tell us, what is the main takeaway of this first chapter of the investigation?
Thank you. I'll say it again. It was February 1993, quite a depressing time for Russia, to say at least. A ton of cocaine had been intercepted at the Russo-Finnish border. Cargo from Colombia that was delivered by the ship and passed the Finnish customs unnoticed as quote-unquote cans of Colombian stew. And according to the head of the local KGB branch, who was Putin's one of the closest ally, Viktor Cherkesov, Russian customs officers noticed that some cans did not have markings, and upon opening them, they found the cocaine inside. And the route had been tracked by authorities in multiple countries, including Israel. And Israel is the only country that convicted some of the people who were behind this operation. They were citizens of Israel. And we've interviewed two people directly linked to this Israel investigation. This was the first interview of the actual person who was convicted for his role in this operation, and the first interview of a witness of this operation that was questioned by Israel investigators. We've also found some Israeli investigative records, Russian police documents that was that were never observed before, and also you can check in our story on our landing page a very unique video and newspaper archives that were never published before. So the Israeli convict says that the paperwork he carried for the cocaine consignment listed a recipient as the St. Petersburg government's public health watchdog, which was under control of the mayor's office. And Putin knew that cocaine will be delivered to St. Petersburg, and he knew that there was a big-scale operation by Interpol to deliver it to Europe and to catch criminals in Europe. But something happened, and Russian police decided to act and captured the cargo itself. Our witness told us that the Israeli businessmen who were one of the main guys in this operation had met with, first of all, Putin's boss, Anatoly Sobchak, and another criminal had met with some mysterious person who was intermediate between Sobchak and criminals and worked for the mayor's office. And he used pseudonym and we didn't find this person, but anyway, it was noticing. And the only person who was arrested by the Russian police in Russia with connection to this case and spent half a year in prison but wasn't convicted is nowadays a famous football agent who worked with several football, or you can say soccer, starts. He's not a criminal anymore, but nobody knew these details about his past. So these are our main points, our main takeaway of this investigation.
Wow, that's pretty incredible. I encourage everyone, if you haven't already, to check out the investigations published in English and in Russian on our websites. And a correction, I guess, in my introduction, I said Cherkasov was the head of the Russian Drug Control Agency at the time. He later became the head of the Russian Drug Control Agency. But he was still all along a confidant of the deputy mayor of St. Petersburg, Vladimir Putin. So, Carl, let's step back and look at the larger significance for a moment of Putin's time in St. Petersburg. Can we draw a direct line from his time as deputy mayor in Petersburg, where this case was one of several scandals, to Russia's political situation today?
Thanks, Mike. Well, I would say one thing you really have to look at, and Andrei is a native of St. Petersburg, so he probably knows this better than I, but I think the complete dominance of organized crime, particularly in St. Petersburg at the time when Putin launched his, basically entered into politics, in the mayor's office. I think that was really formative for how he understood, the relationship between between the state and the electorate, I think it really we see echoes of that in the way Russia's run under under Putin now, and I'm thinking specifically of cronyism, patronage, the use of law enforcement authorities for the enrichment of insiders. I mean, if we just look at the people who have become incredibly wealthy, just the number of Putin friends and insiders who've become enormously wealthy, due in large part to connections to the state cash cow, is really remarkable. I think while it was a much smaller scale in St. Petersburg, you see a lot of the same motifs in Russia today and under Putin's reign. In this particular case, in the cocaine case, what's quite interesting as well is I think this still this idea that the state doesn't owe any sort of accountability to the electorate. When Putin's confidant Viktor Cherkasov, when his team sees this metric ton of cocaine, in the beginning there was a big press conference and promises there'd be a trial. They said they would use the cocaine for medical purposes. It would be repurposed for medical use. And there were regular reports in the police, in the papers about the course of the investigation. And then after that, after these promises that this metric ton of cocaine would be repurposed for medical use, it just completely dropped off the radar. And this was, for me, probably the biggest red flag in the whole story. There was never any, we could never find a single press release or press conference saying, hey, look, we've used all this cocaine to repurpose it for medical use and make all this money for the state. Technically, that metric ton of cocaine was in the hands of the Russian taxpayer. And what happened to it, we have absolutely no idea.
Yeah. So one chapter of Putin's time in St. Petersburg that has been under scrutiny, examined closely in the past, and keeps coming up as a recurring theme is the question of food supplies, because back after the Soviet collapse, St. Petersburg faced food shortages, and City Hall made various arrangements to try and fill the gap and, you know, keep its residents from starving. And those arrangements included barter deals where these fly-by-night firms, these fly-by-night companies, pocketed millions of dollars, despite the fact that no food shipments were, in fact, delivered in exchange. Andre, as Carl said, you're a native of St. Petersburg. Talk to us a little bit about the whole food barter arrangement that was also noteworthy during Putin's time in St. Petersburg politics.
I agree. First of all, I agree with Carl that the main term that you can associate with Putin's regime is impunity. He learned how to do business and how to govern in 1990s, and he was never seriously questioned or convicted for any of the dark stories that he was involved with. And one of the stories was investigated by a Russian politician, Marina Saltykova, in 1992. I remember this time that you could get food or basic products, but you had to pay for them with international currencies. If you needed a cheap food, you had to stay in lines for a very long time, and there was a danger of like a serious problems for the city because of the food shortages. So the mayor's office decided to exchange some earth metals, oil products, and other raw materials for over $100 million. And used barter contracts. In return, the city had to receive some food, but the foodstuffs never materialized. And Marina Saltykova, who was a member of the local parliament, investigated these activities and had access to some documents that had even Putin's signature on them, and it's very easy to check that the city was promised to receive food from some companies and never received any of these very important products that people really needed at that time. And Putin was the person to pick these companies. There was no like a public procurement system with competition and due diligence. He just picked some suspicious companies. Some of them belonged to the friends of the mayor. Some of them belonged to the people close to criminal. Some of them belonged to we don't know who. And city lost these very important oil products and earth materials that could be exported for a price of $100 million, never received any food. Mm-hmm. It happened 30 years ago, and still we can see the same pattern every time with any corruption scandal Putin or his associates were involved in. The same impunity repeats itself all the time.
Carl mentioned that there's a really great video that we published as part of this investigation. You can find it on our website that involves some really fascinating archival footage of the cocaine bust and really does a lot to illuminate this story. And as I mentioned earlier, this first chapter, this first investigation is part of an upcoming series of RFERL stories regarding corruption scandals and scams that swirled around Putin and his associates as he began his political ascent. Carl, talk to us what's coming down the road next.
Yeah, we've got some really interesting stories coming down the pipeline here. They will, they're mostly connected to Putin's External Relations Committee, a very influential committee that Putin headed at the mayor's office. You know, these are corruption stories that are very illustrative of how business was done with his committee during that time. And so I would, for anyone interested in these stories, please keep an eye on our website throughout the week and our Twitter feed, our social media feeds, because we've uncovered details and stories that have seemingly long since been forgotten or never got the scrutiny they deserved in the first place.
And again, as you know, both Andrei and Carl have referred to, you can easily draw a direct line from the early days of Putin's political career in St. Petersburg to the state of leadership and the management style that we have seen, that we're seeing today in today's Russia. And I think there's a lot to be learned in looking at those historical parallels. So I look forward to the next chapter of our investigation. So we have a little bit of time remaining, so let's take a few questions from our listeners. Again, you can raise your hand in the by hitting the button in Twitter Spaces. You can also send us a direct message, or you can post your question as a reply to the tweet pinned in this Twitter space. We'll try to get through as many questions as we can. Let's see what we get for a question, if any. And there may not be any. Again, if you do have a question, you can raise your hand by hitting the button in the Twitter Spaces. You can also send us a direct message or simply post your question as a reply to the tweet pinned in this Twitter space. While we're waiting for a question to come in, I'll throw a question at Carl. Where's Cherkisov now? He's not somebody you hear about a lot these days. Do we know what happened to him?
Yeah, so he has kind of fallen off the map a bit in recent years. So as we said, he served in the KGB together with Putin, was the top FSB official in St. Petersburg for a long time. Then when Putin moved to the Kremlin, Cherkisov got increasingly appointed to increasingly more powerful posts, including as Russia's top narcotics official in 2003. There's an interesting backstory because I think it was 2007 or 2008, there was some really nasty infighting between security agencies, and Cherkisov ended up publishing a letter saying that the security services must not fall victim to this infighting, and it was seen as a really rare example of a security services insider going public with airing basically their dirty laundry publicly. Mm-hmm. He went on to serve in the Duma in the Russian parliament for a few years, but he since 2016 he's been out of parliament, and there's yeah, I don't really have any credible information as to where he is right now or exactly what he's doing.
Interesting. We have one person who has a question, their hand raised. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Clinton DeVoe here, contributor with the Ottawa Hill Times, as well as City News Radio Network in Canada and Troy Media. So based off of the history of Vladimir Putin sort of leaving government military agencies or security agencies and then becoming, becoming a part of the so-called representative government, do we have any sort of idea who who may be a likely successor to Putin based off of some of your understanding of these people that he worked with, you know, at the city level as he eventually became the person that we all know and recognize today? And if we don't have any sort of idea, is that a failure on our part in the West when it comes to our intelligence gathering? Because it seems like the more I hear about what's been happening over the last 3 or 4 months, that there's this fear that a vacuum will be created if and when Putin is removed from office. So I'm just curious your thoughts on that.
Andrei, you want to handle that one? A question of a successor to Putin, and if and when he relinquishes power.
Well, the successor of the Putin is the question of not the near future, I guess. I'm not a political scientist, but I don't see any evidence that he's willing to give any power. And he can leave the presidential office or Kremlin, but he can still be a very influential person, like it happened in Kazakhstan. And speaking about the decision, former Russian President Yeltsin's decision to put Putin on the power, knowing that he had some dirty business in his past, well, I saw how Westerners were very happy with this decision, since he's not a communist and he was not a nationalist, and he never expressed any of these views. And that was enough for the West at the time. And we've seen different Putins over these 20 years. And the first few years of Putin in power, he used to be a reformer. And he relied on some people with liberal and democratic views on how to build an economy. But unfortunately, it was a trap. Because while they were building a strong economy in Russia, a very technocratic state, I would say that many services that were built are very useful and people admire it. But all these budget systems and easy taxes and all this infrastructure was used for PR of illiberal views of Russia inside the country and outside the countries, and for the wars, the war in Chechnya, Second Chechen War, the war in Georgia when Russia annexed the South Ossetia, and the war in Ukraine, which we face right now, and we really need to tell about it because it's atrocities happens there. So now we can definitely see it was a mistake, and that the fact that Putin never expressed any of his views that he expresses now was not enough to be so glad that Yeltsin picked someone insane as it was understood back then.
It's a good reminder how Putin was viewed at the very early days of his presidency. He was indeed embraced as this stabilizing figure and wholly welcomed in the West, and that was 22 years ago. The next pro-Russian presidential election is 2024. All bets are off if there's going to be a presidential election, and who's going to be the successor? There's no real clear indication at this stage in the game. There is another question that's popped up from a listener named Wendy, I believe. Wendy?
Yes.
Hi, go ahead.
I always wanted to work in the State Department, and when Trump took over and he just completely gutted the State Department, it was like a heart, like a knife in my heart. And then he started making some moves on Radio Free Europe, and that was another thing I thought he was doing for Putin, and I just And so he hasn't been able to reverse the post office problem yet. And I'm just wondering if Biden's been able to kind of reverse whatever damage happened to Radio Free Europe.
That is a question that I'm going to have to punt. This podcast is about Russia and Putin and this new investigation that we've published here. That's not to say, you know, there's plenty to be said. It's all positive, I would say. But I'm going to put that question to the side since and keep the discussion more on topic. I see another hand, though I can't tell who the listener is. One second. It's our listener, Clinton, who I believe asked a question previously. Go ahead, Clinton.
Yeah, hi. Thanks a lot. Clinton DeVoe here again. So follow-up question to my previous one. Is there any sort of understanding at the municipal level in Russia, not necessarily someone who has spoken out against Putin, but is there anyone at the municipal level that appears to have consolidated support from you know, people within their respective cities or towns within Russia that could then use that as a way, as leverage, if you will, to sort of follow the path that Putin did, you know, 25, like 30 years ago, that sort of thing?
That's a good question. I have a couple of thoughts that come to mind, but I'm going to kick it to Carl and Andre, see which one of you might have a thought about regional leaders who perhaps have a regional base, an electoral base that could potentially be used to build a larger political movement. Carl, Andre, which one of you wants to handle that?
I can go first. I would say that, you know, from the beginning of Putin's reign, they've been he's been extremely wary of regional leaders with, let's say, too much sway and power in their own regions. You know, that one of his first tasks was to basically rein in the regions that were kind of off doing their own thing. And, you know, you've seen appointments of governors in recent years where people who aren't from the region at all are appointed to you know, lead various regions with which they don't really have much connection at all. So the short answer is I don't see anyone with a type of profile that you could easily say, yes, this person is prepared to step right in. And part of that is I would say, Putin's own doing, and which is extremely problematic, is he has created a system that essentially only he is capable of managing. And at some point, his rule will end. And what happens after that is a big question. I would say the one exception with this is Chechnya, where Ramzan Kadyrov has basically been handed the region and told to, you know, that he can run it however he wishes, even if it's not in compliance with Russian federal laws. But this is just part of a bargain to essentially keep Chechnya quiet, and in exchange for, you know, Kadyrov's basic autonomy there.
Of course,
Thank you for answering my question. I appreciate that.
Of course, there are several examples of actual bodyguards, officers with the Federal Protective Service who have been appointed governors by the Kremlin. And then there's the case of the Khabarovsk governor, Sergei Furgal, who had his wings clipped in a dramatic fashion a couple years back by the Kremlin. Any other questions we can take in the remaining time that we have? It doesn't look like it. So with that, I'm going to call it a day and say thank you both to Andre and Carl for joining us both. And again, I remind people, please go check out the investigation in Russian and English on our websites, and be on the lookout for the next installment of our investigation into the political corruption scandals and scams that that characterized Putin's early years in St. Petersburg. Again, this conversation will also be published, republished as a podcast. You can find it on our website. You can also subscribe to The Week Ahead in Russia and find many of RFERL's other podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and other similar places. I'm Mike Eckel. Thanks for listening.
Dia em que você chegou, tudo em minha vida mudou, pois com você perto de mim, minha tristeza teve fim. Obrigado pelo bem que você causou, bendito seja o dia em que você chegou. Obrigado pelo bem que você causou, bendito seja o dia em que você chegou. Mas se um dia, meu bem, você se for, sei que não suportarei a dor. Coitado de mim que não vou mais sorrir, maldito seja o dia em que você partir. Coitado de mim que não vou mais sorrir, maldito seja o dia em que você partir. Mas se um dia você, meu bem, chorar e quiser então voltar, só posso lhe dizer que sim, só posso lhe dizer assim. Obrigado, meu bem, por querer voltar. Bendito seja o dia em que você chegar. Obrigado, meu bem, por querer voltar. Bendito seja o dia em que você chegar. Obrigado, meu bem, por querer voltar. Bendito seja o dia em que você chegar. Obrigado, meu bem, por querer voltar. Bendito seja o dia em que você chega. Só
chance de quanto sua vida na morte. Jornais todos anunciam do Cineia que vai se casar. A vida é um banho, o sol e o caminho do sol de Quixote, chupado chicote. O sol tem chance e a chance de chicote. O vento e a moto mascando Quixote. Chicote no sítio, no rio, sem rio, no corro, no coxo, no rio, no corpo. O desse caminho, sem sítio, Quixote, sua chance, chicote, sua vida.
International Day of this we will pray as we ask possible for the world, this great pursuit of justice and fairness for all human beings of race, color, and creed.
I realize my USB cable isn't long enough.
Oh shit. I think, is it the Apple one? No.
No. But it is, but it's live.
Why is it connected to your laptop?
I don't know. Because that's what the internet is.
Ah, that's really, it's live, yeah, yeah.
I would like to share with you all a story.
But I'm not, no, then I can't use it later, actually.
Without the courage and determination of just a handful of young optimists that are sitting around the world.
The recording.
Take you back to
record.
It won't be recorded. Oh, it will be, yeah. No, actually, I can download it from the server.
27 law students from 8 Sinhalan countries gathered to explore what an available international mechanism exists that they can.
But I brought like a tripod and stuff to like, so I could hold it up.
Creating climate action. And it was in this moment when the campaign to seek an advisory opinion on climate change from the
international. Yeah, so then we cannot talk anymore.
I hope to explain this campaign with an analogy. In the Solomon Islands, where I come from, where traditional communities are crucial when they're addressing a problem, oftentimes they will seek advice of the person with the most legitimate and highest authority, that is the chief. Now, the villagers do not have to abide by the chief's advice, but because his advice is based on his extensive knowledge and experience of past agreements, traditional customs, general principles and practices of the community, the villagers respect and comply with the chief's advice, and as it clarifies their obligations and encourages them to do the right
thing. Maybe I just go in the middle of it.
This is precisely what we hope the ICJ, the great chief of 193 states, can do for climate change. Not limited to an advisory opinion on climate change has three main benefits to the climate justice movement. Benefit number one, the ICJ can endorse the best scientific consensus on climate change, removing any doubts on climate denialism and cementing the authority of science in decision making and raising global consciousness. Benefit number two, complementing the Paris Agreement, especially by providing clarity on state obligations in the gaps in ambition, accountability, and fairness. And benefit number three, integrating international human rights law and climate change law to bolster the mandates of human rights bodies to systematically tackle climate change, placing human rights in the center of the climate crisis. Comrades, this is the final decade of climate action. But the fate of human civilization depends on bold, innovative actions. What we must take today, we must attempt every possible course of action that's available to us. In our case, it is time to take the world's biggest problem to the world's highest goal. So hopefully, one day, we can look our children in the eyes and say to them that we have exhausted all available tools in our toolbox. We have raised a voice and a fist as high as we could to ensure that they have a green, just, and equitable future. A future where all governments, international institutions, corporations, and private sectors recognize their and uphold their obligations to protect the rights of the current and future generations from the adverse effects of climate change. A future where cooperation between global north and global south countries to address the climate crisis is truly respectful towards their common but differentiated responsibilities. A future where the protection and fulfillment of human rights has no double standards and not meaningful only to the color of white. Thank you.
this climate justice movement, we're playing different roles, we're fighting on different fronts, but we must not forget that we're living in an ecosystem, and we are all interconnected.
He has headphones, yeah, with the headphones. With the headphones. Can you bring in the headphones?
Yeah. When you're beaten, when you're tired, when you're hungry, when you're suffering, when you're hopeless, always remember that your brothers and sisters in other parts of the world will be fighting for your rights and for this beautiful planet. Thank you, and thank you for us.
Nederlands voor jullie. 27 studenten hebben gewoon samengezeten aan de University of the Pacific. Is het University of the Pacific? University of South Pacific. 27 rechtenstudenten zitten samen om te kijken wat kunnen we doen. We moeten alles proberen, alle instrumenten die we in huis hebben, alles wat iedereen kan doen. Maar dit was voor hun een hele belangrijke weg. We gaan nu gewoon naar de hoogste orgaan in het recht te kunnen bedenken. Het gaat om rechtvaardigheid, het recht, inderdaad. Het internationaal gerechtshof, wat hier vlakbij is. And I want to ask you, Solomon, because we're right here in the Netherlands, the ICJ is here as well. What can we do to really make this happen? What is our role, you think, in fighting for your rights as well?
I believe everyone who is here today is already helping. I think this, as I said, we're all working towards the same goal. And I was talking to my friend today that before, back in the day, even the notion of climate justice didn't even came to me. And now I can see many of signs here holding about the whole climate justice. And that is what is recorded in the sky. We want to live what sort of future are we going to live for children? And it doesn't require one single solution. There are multitude of solutions that we are going to address. And I'm sure many of these people here are taking different sorts of solutions. But we are heading to the same goal, as I said.
Yeah, we're here to support. Yeah. Thank you so much.
So God bless you. You advocate and fight for climate justice. You're already supporting us.
Nice. Fantastic. Eilandstaten zijn zo kwetsbaar in het geheel. Voor stijgende zeespiegels, erosie, orkanen, verlies van ecosystemen, watervoorraden. Ze staan echt onder druk. En dat is niet alleen relevant in de Pacific, dat is ook voor ons in het Koninkrijk der Nederlanden. Want ik denk, samen weten we het wel. Hoeveel landen is het Koninkrijk der Nederlanden eigenlijk?
Vier.
Hoeveel landen zijn wij?
Vier.
Vier, ja. Dankjewel. Eerst antwoord hebben we. Welke landen zijn dat?
Nederland, Aruba, Curaçao, Sint Maarten.
Nou, welke landen zijn er? Vier landen?
Curaçao, Aruba!
Nederland. Curaçao, heel goed. Goed opgelet. En? Sint Maarten, dankjewel. We hebben ze alle vier. Nederland, Aruba, Curaçao en Sint Maarten. We hebben ook het gemeente in Caribisch Nederland. Welke zijn dat? Bonaire, Stasjas en Pistachios en Saba, precies. We hebben een groot deel van het land. Het zijn eilanden, net als in de Pacific, en zijn heel erg kwetsbaar. En weet je, dankzij onze koloniale geschiedenis is dat zo. Maar nu, in het heden, we besteden er vrouwen geen aandacht aan. Er worden vrouwen geen voorzieningen getroffen. Ook het recht helpt hier niet in mee. Op Sint-Eustatius en Saba is nu al niet goed drinkwater. Dus er worden gewoon mensenrechten geschonden in ons eigen koninkrijk. En dat kan niet. Dat kan niet. Eilanden, dankjewel. Ja. En dat is ook een van onze eisen hier. Van sta op, geef een stem en geef steun aan gemeenschappen die het hardst worden getroffen. En die ons nu nodig hebben. Ja, we're good. I we have a lot of islands that do not get the attention they deserve in this fight. So thank you for, we're all connected in this fight. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now! Now! Don't you leave now. Okay, let's go. Wij laten zien dat we hier staan en wij zorgen voor dit draagvlak. En daarom hebben we een mars zoals deze, we hebben de klimaatmars nodig om te laten zien dat er een draagvlak is binnen de Nederlandse politiek. Zodat we het ook kunnen aankaarten, dat we voor samen kunnen vechten, dat we voor alle Nederlandse eilanden ook kunnen vechten. En dat, daarvoor zijn wij ook hier en daarom staan we hier ook. Dus even... Groot applaus, dit is het. We staan hier met z'n allen. Groot applaus voor jezelf. Ik ben zo blij dat jullie hier zijn. En daar de Klimaatcrisiscoalitie, ze hebben dit helemaal georganiseerd, gefaciliteerd. Ook even een heel groot applaus. Het is al heel lang in de werk. Het klinkt ontzettend goed, vind ik bijzonder.
Wie zijn er achter? Partij voor de Dieren,